You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So the title of our panel is I Can Hear Her Breathing. It's going to be led by Grace Pengelly-Beckett, over here. We have Brian McLaren. Woo! We have Kate Raworth.
Ray.
And we have Layla McKellar. As you've noticed, that is a change from the programme. So we've replaced Brian Eno with Brian McLaren. And unfortunately, Dawood Nassar couldn't be here for the festival. I'm going to hand over now to Grace. Thank you very much. A round of applause for our panel.
Hello, Greenbelt. Welcome. The sun is out. The music is pumping. How are we all doing? Yay! Okay, so we're here to talk about other worlds. Are other worlds on their way? Are we being overly optimistic? How are we going to hear them when they're on their way? We're going to get to the optimistic stuff, I promise, probably in the second half. Before we do, just to give you a slightly more in-depth intro to our panelists in case you're unfamiliar with them. So Brian McLaren needs no introduction at Greenbelt. He's an author, speaker, activist and public theologian who we all love immensely. And we're just thrilled that he could step in for Brian Eno. Kate Raworth is an economist, author of Donut Economics and founder of the Donut Economics Action Lab. And Layla McKellar, who's absolutely gorgeous dulcet tones we just heard over on main stage, is with us from America. Did you hear her? Yeah, was she amazing? Excellent. Yeah, stunning. Thank you so much for being here. So, does anybody know where this quote, I can hear her breathing, comes from? Arundhati Roy, exactly. Brilliant. So, I'm going to read out the whole thing. To kind of kick off and frame the discussion that we're going to have today. So, it was taken from a book called An Ordinary Person's Guide to Empire. The corporate revolution will collapse if we refuse to buy what they are selling, their ideas, their version of history, their wars, their weapons, their notion of inevitability. Another world is not only possible. She is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. How apt. We're in the noisiest venue ever. So I think we've got an interesting starting point for this discussion, because Arundhati seems here to be saying that our starting point is that this world is somehow broken and in need of transformation. And I guess I want to open up initially to our panelists and say, do you agree? And also, what are the pros and cons of framing a discussion about the future in this way? So are there pros and cons to saying we need to kind of dispense with everything and just start over? Who would like to kick off? Maybe Brian.
I was really hoping someone else would kick off. Well, maybe a quick anecdote. I mentioned this morning that I wrote a book in 2006 called Everything Must Change, 2007. And I was trying to understand the state of the world. And at the end of that book, this only made it into two sentences in the book. But I remember having this feeling from the people I was talking to and the books I was reading that there was this fork in the road. And one fork was, we try to heal the global economy and make it more just and more sustainable. And the other fork was people who are saying that will never happen. It's impossible. So we have to start planting the seeds for an economy that will happen after that economy collapses. And when I felt the gravity of that choice, I remember thinking, I can't write about this in the book, because it will suck all the air out of the room of everything else I was saying. So that actually became almost the starting point for my most recent book. So I don't know which fork in that road can take. I do know that many of the people who take one fork are very angry at the people who take the other, because they feel they're opposites. I personally think when you have a situation of great risk, you need to multiply your possible solutions. You don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket? And so I think we need people who are imagining how the global economy could be salvaged, made more sustainable and more just, and go through a very radical shift that's not just the shift of decarbonizing. That's important, but decarbonizing, in my opinion, is the visible tip of a fast melting iceberg of the larger issue of ecological overshoot of not living in a sustainable way with the earth. But I think we need people devoting their best effort to this, and then other people saying, and if that fails, we're also thinking about this other option. So that'd be my thought.
Fantastic. Kate, do you want to?
I mean, the thing that comes up for me is, you know, that quote says, on a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. I think we need to be able to hear it on the loud days, case in point. And that's really the challenge.
Yeah.
Is that when the noise is really loud, it's like, well, where is the compass? Does the compass still point north? Mm. And, you know, I think that, I don't know, one of my favorite thinkers right now in the world is a person named Adrienne Marie Brown, who you've heard of Adrienne Marie Brown, but she says the apocalypse is always happening. And I, as like depressing as that is, potentially, I find it really helpful to think about the world that way, because, you know, and I do a lot of like kind of like ancestral healing work with my music, and I think about that a lot. And I think the thing is that people want instant gratification, when really the changes that we're trying to create in the world, we might not be able to see them during our lifetime. And that's the grief that we have to hold in our lives, like in this moment, that we have to push for things that we might not see, but maybe someone will see them, and maybe it'll be our kids, maybe it'll be our grandkids, maybe it'll be our friends' kids, or, you know, something. But like, you know, that I think that that's a philosophical choice, you know, and that's the one that I choose, is that I try to work towards the things that I want to see, but accept that I might not see them.
Kate, what do you think about what Layla just said about the challenges sometimes pushing for things that we can't see? Because I think we're, you know, in culturally right now, we just want immediate gratification. We want those quick wins. We want, you know, everything to happen instantly. Perhaps rightly so. We've got protesters, you know, putting themselves in the line of fire, particularly in the UK. How do we do that, like the deep work that needs to be done in order to kind of bring this new world into being without losing hope?
Okay, so in terms of the world, right? I mean, Dati Roy says the world. So I have in my little pocket, if you can see, a little glass marble, like the world, planet Earth. If we, to do deeper work, first let's pull back and think of this, the world. This isn't broken. This world is highly competent. This life has been evolving and creating conditions conducive to life for 3.8 billion years on this planet. It works phenomenally well. And then the human systems, and that's what we're jumping to talking about, I don't even think they're broken, because they really work very, very well for some very powerful people who are accumulating huge power and resource and advantage through them. So they're not, to me, they're not broken, but they are profoundly out of alignment with life. And they don't work for justice, and they don't work for ecological health. So to do the deeper work for me, I'm thinking of it from an economics point of view, I think we need to deeply redesign our economic systems. From a point of view of justice and ecology, they are broken because they weren't designed for that. And what's exciting to me in the space of hope, what would it look like to design economic institutions, from the design of a company to the design of education to design of democracy, to be aligned with life, to be in service to life. That's what excites me.
Yeah, absolutely. So in differing ways, all of your work kind of encompasses ushering in this new world into being. You are all people who kind of listen and enable this different world to arrive. So what is it that you guys can hear? And what are the birth pangs, which is appropriate for me right now, what are the birth pangs that we should be looking out for? Because I think there's often this narrative that, you know, the world is only going to change in the future. Maybe I'm pushing back against what you said, Layla, here. But like, it's only going to happen for our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren. And I think what Arundhati is actually saying is like, no, it's happening in the here and now. So what is it in the here and now that makes you convinced that this is possible, that we can do this, that we can, you know, turn around so many of these disconnections that we've created with our planet and with each other?
You know, I don't know. I don't, obviously no one here has all the answers. I think that we have to be able to manage disappointment and still strategize, you know? I mean, maybe I'm thinking of it from a super American perspective because, you know, we're at this kind of like really fragile point in history. And, you know, everyone's like, what's going to happen with the presidency? But like, you know, the change that we are seeking on this planet is not coming from the presidency. You know, it is coming from each other. It's coming from how we care for each other, from you know, the way that we are kind of committing to and building these systems. And I think we've seen them change already in our lifetimes. But I do feel like there is kind of like this, you know, and maybe it's also just living in a capitalist, you know, global capitalist society. I think it makes us feel that we are powerless, and we're not. But we also, you know, I feel, you know, maybe, again, maybe this is more of a personal experience kind of thing, but managing, being able to manage disappointment and shapeshift, you know, in terms of movement work and, you know, strategizing for these changes that we seek, which we're speaking very vaguely about these changes, but I think we, you know, we're all talking about equitability and access to food and, you know, sustainability for our planet. But I don't know. I see that as a potential starting point.
Yeah. Thank you. Birth pangs.
Can you restate your question just to be sure?
Yeah. So kind of what is it that we're listening out for, and what are the birth pangs? Yeah. Is it just something that's going to happen in the far and distant future?
Yes. So let me say two things that are opposite. The first is, honestly, I'm listening for things to not work, because it's only when things don't work that things get worse, and it's only when things get worse that people want to make them better. And when things get a lot worse, they want to make them a lot better, you know? And so, and you made me think of this, Layla, when you said disappointment, because I'm disappointed when things go badly and aren't working. But then I think, but maybe the conditions have to get worse to make people creative enough to imagine things could be way better, right? The second thing is, I actually think so many people are changing. I was part of a political thing in the last election where I was involved with this group of social scientists who were doing research on how they could get people to change their vote, people who were planning to vote for Donald Trump, to get them to change their vote. And it was so depressing because it turns out tiny fractions of a percent of people ever change their vote and ever change their party. And a group of us were all sitting around talking about how depressing this was. And then one of them said, yeah, but I changed. There were four of us in the conversation. One said, yeah, but I changed. And then the other one said, I changed. The other said, I said, I changed. So we felt like, well, there are four of us who've changed. And I think that's happening. I think there is this sort of reality that people are changing. You know, in my life, I was a pastor for 24 years, and the amount of change I went through in my life as a pastor was staggering. And some years ago, I was brought into this interfaith group, and everyone in the group, there were rabbis. They'd had a parallel shift in their way of thinking as rabbis, and there were imams. They'd had a parallel shift in their thinking as Muslims, and there were Buddhists who'd had parallel shifts. So I think we're out there and we find each other, and maybe part of what we hear breathing is the person next to us who's breathing out the same desire for change.
So I'll pick up on that as well. Where can I hear the birth pangs? By the way, Grace, just to check, if you actually start having birth pangs, you will let us know, right?
I'll let you know. Okay. I'll let you know.
Okay. So I wrote a book about donut economics. It's about rethinking the economy as if we put the rights of all people and the integrity of the living planet at the center of economics, and then ask what kind of economic mindset would we advocate and follow. So it came out in 2017. And in fact, I came here to Greenbelt in 2017 or 2018, and I had real fun talking about it. And my plan was to actually keep going around talking about it, doing a bit of economic circus like I did today. But what happened was that people started coming up to me and not just saying, I really like the ideas in this book. They said, I love these ideas and I want to put this into practice in my company, in my school. I'm going to teach this. In fact, I already am teaching this. I've pushed aside the syllabus. This is what the kids should learn. Or can I do this in my town? I want to put this at the heart of our city. So we realized these practitioners actually wanted to do it. They wanted to make it breathe. So I put aside the economic circus for a long time, and I co-founded an organization called Donut Economics Action Lab. The meaning is in the name. It's all about action. Let's work with the people who want to put this into action. And it's a lab. It's one big experiment. The book that Layla just referred to by Adrian Marie Brown, she wrote a fantastic book called Emergent Strategy. We don't know where we're going. It's going to emerge. Follow it. And so we've spent the last 7 years working with pioneers and change makers in towns and city councils. There are over 90 around the world now that have voluntarily adopted this and publicly said, we're going to do this. With teachers in classrooms and universities, with really progressive businesses, employee-owned, cooperatively-owned, who can design their company to be in service to the world, not just in service to financial returns, with community organizations. So that's where I hear it breathing. And I just want to reflect on the last thing Brian said. You said, perhaps we were sitting next to each other and we could hear each other breathing. The biggest powerful force of change that I've observed in the work I'm doing is peer-to-peer inspiration. So it's one thing for me to get up on a stage and say, hey, what if cities wanted to adopt the donut and put it at the heart of their city strategy? Fine. It's completely different when the first mayor, the first city, which was Amsterdam in 2019, the vice mayor of sustainability in Amsterdam said, we are basing our circularity strategy on the donut. But of course, because it makes sense. Within 6 weeks, the city of Copenhagen organized and voted with a great majority to explore this themselves. Then Brussels, then Barcelona, and then it's happening all over Europe. Then it's going to El Monte in Chile, in Saldanha Bay in South Africa, to Ipoh in Malaysia. It's peer-to-peer inspiration, and I think peer-to-peer permission. Yes. It's time. Oh, my peers are moving. It's time. So I think many people want to move, and it's when we see others we admire or associate moving, we're inspired and we have permission to move too. And that's what gives me energy and hope and the creativity of people say, thank you for the donut. Look what we've done with it. And they give it back in the most amazing, playful, transformed, more useful way. And we share that back. Just to say, if you're interested, if you go to donuteconomics.org, that's our platform. Everything is in the commons. It's for use for free. We just ask for reciprocity. Please share back what you did with it, what you learned, or what you experimented, because that's how others get inspired.
I was just hoping, would you be able to talk about Civic Square a little bit? Because I think so often we have these like big abstract conversations at Greenbelt and it's lovely and we all go away feeling very revved up. But I first encountered Civic Square about 6 months ago. I did a bit of work for them, and they are putting Kate's model of donor economics into practice in a really concrete way. So I'd love it if you could just share a little bit of their story with our audience.
Sure. So Civic Square is a community-based organization based in Ladywood, which is one of the most underserved communities in Birmingham, not very far away. Yeah, look, can we hear it for Bron? Oh yeah. So I met them actually via Twitter before it got toxic. It was a very useful place to meet people. They invited me to go there for the day. They said, we're interested in donor economics, will you come? When I walked in to that community, it was one of the most multicultural, multi-faith community groups I'd been in, and I felt very humbled. Right here is they are managing to create something that I've not sensed elsewhere myself in the UK, first of all. It was totally a group working in a local community, going door to door. And what the very tangible project they're working on is street level retrofit. It does not make sense for every single household to have to figure out, how should I get my house insulated? What kind of solar panels? Do I want an air source heat pump or not? How much will it cost? It's crazy that we're all trying to figure this out alone. Civic Square can see that what if streets did this together? What if every neighborhood had a little hub organization that a street could go to? Retrofit our houses at the same time, it'll be a fraction of the price. Let's all fit solar panels at the same time. It'll save everyone time and money and hassle. So they are trying to show like a demonstration site there in Birmingham. And again, they're really good at sharing everything they're learning and everything that's not working and everything that is. So if you look them up, Civic Square, they do wonderful events. They also welcome people. They hold a mini festival there in Birmingham, have tents like this, local community makers from around the country talking about trying to retrofit their street, trying to set up a community library. It's very, very locally grounded, and they can see the value of that spreading nationally and internationally, and I hugely admire their work. So yeah, please do look them up if you want some very grounded inspiration.
Yeah. Second that, do go and check out Civic Square when you go home on your way from Greenbelt. Layla and Brian, I'm aware that we've got, some American representation on the panel today. I'd love to just hear about your specific local context in a kind of similar way that Kate has shared. Obviously, we've been following what's going on at the DNC. Beyonce did not make an appearance. What happened? But I would love for you to just share what's going on in your local community. Is there anything kind of similar that corresponds to what Kate is talking about in terms of these small connections? I guess going back to what Adrienne Marie Brown is talking about as well. Could you be able to talk about that?
I live in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I've been living there for almost 15 years now, and I think what really attracted me to the place was the kind of community commitment to culture. I moved there at a time in my life when I was really looking for people to play music with and, figuring out what was going to be my sort of the shape my expression took. And there's just so much music. There's so much gathering. I think in a in a political environment where the word Palestine is not said out loud, is not encouraged, and is actually really repressed, I've been really impressed to see my musician organizer friends, New Orleans Musicians for Palestine, do so much organizing. I mean, last Mardi Gras, Mardi Gras in New Orleans it's carnival time. Everyone's just cutting loose and going to parades, and New Orleans Musicians for Palestine were out in the streets every day learning Palestinian songs, learning, just doing them in a New Orleans kind of brass band way. And to me, I feel like that's that peer-to-peer influence. It's like, okay, what's the thing that we're losing, you know, beyond these thousands and thousands of lives in this genocide? It's culture. Culture is being suppressed. And how do we keep that alive? By keeping it alive, by practicing it, by being out in the street. And I had so many moving experiences where I went and, you know, just marched with my friends who were arranging Palestinian songs. And it's like, it feels like such a drop in the bucket in certain ways. And then in other ways, it's like, no, this is important. This is keeping something alive. And that's how things are kept alive, by nurture and maintenance and building community around them and getting people to hear it. And, you know, it wasn't all, you know, just out in the streets having a blast. I mean, there were people that were just like standing on their porch steps and, you know, refusing to take that we were handing out poetry and Palestinian poems. And, you know, it's not everyone was, you know, available for that. But I think that presence, that gathering, it filled me with so much feeling of connection. And it's like, this is the thing that people are looking for. They're looking for connection. They're looking for why should I care, you know? And I think there's a number of ways to go about that. You know, I've been to organizing things, you know, educating children about what's happening in Palestine. And that's scary in a way, you know, and I think children are so much more resilient than we give them credit for being. They can handle it. They know what's up already, even when you're trying to hide it from them. So, you know, I found that to be really beautiful. I went to an event with my kids where we were cutting out birds. It was Birds for Palestine, which is probably another just, you know, someone just had an idea. We're gonna make these cutouts of birds, and we're gonna get kids to paint them, and we're gonna make these beautiful sort of mobiles. And I did that with my kids, and there was a part of me that, you know, it was so emotional, because there was a part of me that was like, how do I explain this to them? And then I just did, and they just got it, and they, you know, they got really into making art and understanding it, understanding the value of life. I mean, those are, I think, essential lessons that feel very heavy, because we're carrying our adult kind of attachment and conception of what it means to lose life. But I think if we stay with what it means to keep on creating it, keep on creating culture, and keep on shifting things, that's kind of what I'm invested in.
And I think kind of not being afraid of being with the pain, being with the grief, being in those, you know, really difficult places. I think that one of the biggest risks for Palestine is that there's just a numbness that sets in the kind of global, you know, psyche. It's so important for us to kind of just keep on grounding ourselves and saying, I'm not going to become numb to this. I'm not going to become numb to this. Because that ultimately is what, you know, the people bombing Gaza, Palestine are banking on, right? They're banking on fatigue in the public imagination. Brian, would you be able to talk about kind of your local context as well?
Yeah, Layla and I live in what are called very red states, and we live sort of around the Gulf of Mexico from each other. But if I were to look on the big scheme of things in my state, almost all of the news is bad in the big scheme. Our last two governors have told all state employees they cannot use the word climate change or global warming. It's a fireable offense. Our governor just recently passed a law that said no government agencies or municipalities are allowed to pass new laws to protect workers from heat. I mean, the stupidity and idiocy and backwardness and foolishness of these actions is stunning, but it's showing a group of people who are doubling down on their efforts of denial and suppression of the truth. Our state is famous for book banning. That just tells you it's white people who don't want the true history of what white people have done to be told. So it's just absurd, it's ridiculous, it's backward. Meanwhile, though, people see reality and things are changing. And the one place that the truth is breaking through is where it hurts people most, in their wallet. So because our state is denying the realities of climate change, insurance rates are going through the roof and people can't get insurance for their property. And so the irony is, while the state tries to suppress the truth, reality is breaking out in insurance rates. And this is where it requires, as Adrienne Marie Brown so wisely says, and as Layla was saying, this requires patience and the ability to bear with setbacks, but to have the longer view in mind and to say, if they're not going to listen at this current amount of pain, the pain will get worse, and maybe then they'll be able to listen. And there's all kinds of pain and grief with that. But yeah, that's my honest feeling.
Yeah. So before I respond, though, I'm having a creeping feeling that sitting here in my shag coat, in my leather armchair, I'm beginning to feel like a mafia boss. So, Brian, we are going to swap. I said we would swap at the beginning. So he'll get the comfy chair.
I think we should trade.
No, we're cool. Okay, so just so many wonderful thoughts coming out. I just want to reflect that. Yeah, yeah. Mafia boss.
You got your cigar.
I love what Layla was sharing. My head is trying to imagine a New Orleans brass band playing Palestinian music in its own style. And I love what that encapsulates, because there is no one breath, song, answer, policy, solution that works everywhere. But the beauty of when people of one place say, I hear you, I see that idea, I see that policy, I hear your song, I hear your feeling, I take it, and through me, this is what I can share back. And that's, whether that's happening in the music, and that's what we're seeing happening in places that are saying, yeah, we want to put a new economy into action. By the way, it's not going to look like anybody else's place. You know, we're not going to call it donut here. We're going to call it Ciambella in Italy. We're going to call it Vadu in India. We're going to give it different names. And the different policies are required because we're different here. And our ecology is different. So I love that. I want to hear that music. Also, this point about how do we make sure we don't stay numb, not only to atrocities that humans inflict on each other, but of course to the feedback that the earth is sending to us, that, you know, the experience, whether you're turning the news pages or scrolling, another flood, another drought, another hurricane. Where is it this month? What was it called? Can we really remember them? Because we start to become used to it. And how, again, like Grace's question, how do we stay alive to it? As you were talking, Grace, I was thinking, I think one of the things that switches people from active engagement to a feeling of numbness or resignation is when we lose any sense that we could have agency in helping change this. We just feel passive, unable to make a change. So to look deeper at the system of which we're a part that's causing it, whether it's atrocity on other communities or whether it's ecological breakdown, how can I change and take steps in the way that I eat and the way that I travel and the way I bank and the way I invest and divest and how I protest and how I volunteer and how I vote? Because those are all things we can tangibly do, and they do have connection to these much bigger systems. So for me, it's about keeping awareness of where we do have agency and how we can come together. That stops us feeling it's too big, I'm numb to it, I'm out of it. And it's so important for us to stay there.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. So I work with a lot of artists and writers and novelists. Arundhati Roy is a fantastic novelist, and one of the things that I always come back to in my work is the role of imagination and the role of artists like Leila, like Arundhati, in keeping that muscle, that imagination muscle alive. Because do you know what? It's bloody hard work. Like, I sit down to write sometimes and I'm like, I got nothing. But it's that kind of it's that continual process of like showing up each day. Leila, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your kind of creative practice and how you keep yourself open to those channels, especially in times of like heartache and, you know, brutality that we're experiencing now. Because I know in my own practice, sometimes I'm just like, I just can't show up and use my imagination today. And that's a problem when that's how you make your money or want to share things with the world.
I think this is a really... I don't show up every day. I think that's how the imagination stays alive. It isn't like... I don't know. It feels like, you know, I always wanted to be the kind of artist that could just like consistently plug away and just chip at my piece of wood in my brain until it becomes something really beautiful. For me, it's always been an avalanche after a drought. You know, it's just always, it's always this ebb and flow. And I think for me, you know, understanding how my imagination works, and of course it's a very individual thing, you know, when you're an artist, everyone makes art in different ways. It's actually being able to listen to what I'm even trying to think about or say. I mean, I'm a single mom. I have three kids. I live in a pretty consistent state of overwhelm. And so for me, it's more like, when I do have that time, when I do have an idea, can I seize the moment? Can I, you know, silence myself? Am I rested enough? Did I drink enough water? I mean, it's really, really basic kind of stuff that I feel like keeps the machines plugging away. But I try to listen to what other people are doing and what other people are saying. I read a lot. I listen to podcasts. You know, half of the time I'm like, I need to clean the house. And the house is always falling apart and the house is never clean enough. But like, you know, that's a time where I'm like, okay, how can I feed it? What am I feeding my imagination when I'm feeling like I'm not creating, you know? It's like, okay, if you can't create all the time, then we all are ingesting things all the time. And, you know, what am I ingesting? That's beautiful over there. They're feeding me right now, being fed.
Yeah. I love
it. I mean, and even this conversation, you know, that's really what I love about being up here is not what I'm thinking or what I have to say, but what I'm taking in from what you are sharing. I need that as an artist and I need that as who I am. And I think we all need that on some level in our lives. It's like we need to be the soul food that's going to allow us to imagine that next move in our life or that next relationship or that next job or that next chapter, or that next thing that we want, you know? And I think that there's a lot of connection between the sort of individual experience and the collective experience. And I'm very interested in that and think about that a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I love this word you used about like being available to listen. It feels very apt as we've just regained normal audio levels. I'm interested to hear, Brian, about, you know, because you're pretty prolific in terms of your output. Do you have time to listen ever in your life? And, you know, what are your practices for kind of cultivating that?
Okay, so I live... When I'm not traveling, I live a very quiet life. And I walk, I get outdoors a lot, and that's what I need to survive. I think the two things that recharge me and stimulate my imagination, just being listening to the logic and the language of the world, of the physical living and non-living world, and exposing myself to creative and artistic people whose creativity inspires me. Listening to Layla today was just a joy, and the gumbo of the music that she puts together is just amazing. And I was here 7 years ago when Kate was here, and I was in a tent somewhere around here and hearing her speak. And I'll just tell you, you know, one of the things a lot of people don't realize for a nonfiction writer, there is enormous creativity and the ability to find a simple, clear image like donut economics. This simple idea that how about we put well-being in the center and build an economy around that rather than putting profit in the center, financial profit only for certain people. And I mean, a simple image augmented by sugar and fat, which is a good, a smart, sweet move. But, you know, sometimes it's that simple image that a person brings that helps, that just opens things up. And I think that's true of that Arundhati Roy quote. This sense that, oh, the world we're waiting for isn't waiting. It's not all in the future. We may have to wait. It may be generations ahead before the breakthroughs we need fully, you know, happen. But it's breathing now. It's part of the logic of life. It's there in the passing of seasons. It's there in the tides coming in and going out. It's there in a few weeks when the leaves start turning yellow and fading away. And all of that is whispering to us of this deep wisdom and logic of life.
Thank you. I'd love to jump in there. So I love that Brian's brought us back to the literal words of Arundhati Roy's quote, which is, I can hear her breathing. And it's unusual, isn't it, that she talked about, I can hear it. Sometimes we say, I can see it. So thinking about the way we use our different senses and talking about a different future, we very much do it often through words. In universities, it's a discipline and we are analyzing words all the time. And I think we end up very trained to analyze words. Well, that's a contested concept and we debate and write essays and it's word-based. And I think actually we can tap into it so much more if we use other senses. So what would it sound like? If anyone's familiar with the work of Rob Hopkins, who was one of the founders of the Transition Towns movement, he has a wonderful podcast. He wrote a book from What Is to What If, and he loves asking this question, what if? But of all his guests on the podcast, he says to them, what would this transitioned world sound like? What would we hear? What would transport sound like? What would a high street sound like? What would a Sunday morning sound like? And it's a beautiful, different kind of imagining. Since you were just talking about the power of a picture, I learned through drawing a donut because, you know, some people are very visual and I like pictures and I was always doodling around the edges of my essays. And you realize actually those doodles are as powerful as the words because it's about visual framing. So verbal framing, just very quickly, verbal framing, like if in the US, a lot of politicians, particularly on the right, will talk about tax relief. We need tax relief. And cognitive linguists will say, don't engage with that frame if you don't agree, because relief, who doesn't want relief? Don't argue against tax relief, argue for tax justice. Reframe it, right? So that's a verbal reframe. And for me, a visual reframe is just as important. Mainstream economics, if I ask roomfuls of people, let me try it right now. Raise your hand if you ever studied economics in any form at all. Oh, look, you see lots of us. Okay, what's the first diagram you ever remember learning? I did not prep that, okay? I don't know of any other discipline where you could ask people what was the first, and they all would, like that. That was like a hymn, right? That comes right back at you. There's the same choir sheet. So supply and demand, it goes deep into our minds. It's the market. The metric is price. The pursuit is profit. And it goes for endless growth. It's deep visual framing. If instead we start with, like the donut, meet the needs of all within the means of the planet, it's the goal. It's the big picture. So whether we're thinking, what does a future sound like? What does a future look like? What are the images that we need as much as the words we need? What are the songs we need? the tunes and the different melodies that completely touch a different part of our hearts and bodies. So here's to multi-sensorial imagining, because it unleashes our imagination, and that's what a festival like this is so wonderful for.
So in about 5 minutes or so, I think we're going to open up to some questions, some nice, concise, short questions, not comments. Before we do, another little pop quiz for you, because Kate's worked so well. Anybody got any ideas on when Arundhati Roy's quote that we've been talking about was first published? Any guesses? 20 years ago? Who said that? Yeah. So 2005 was when Arundhati wrote these words: "Another world is not only possible. She's on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Some of you may be aware that Arundhati is currently facing the probability of jail time. The issues that she's talked about only seem to be getting worse. So she was writing about the war on terror and the growing threat of corporate power 20 years ago. Does anybody think that her optimism was misplaced? Or how are we feeling at the end of this panel? Are we feeling optimistic and like we're on board with Arundhati's vision?
I'd love to say something about that. I just think if we keep framing things in terms of optimism and pessimism, it's going to hurt us. This was one of the big struggles I've been through and grappling with whatever I've been working on in these last few years. Here's a way I could explain it. If you study ethics, a basic ethics class, very often they'll talk about three kinds of ethics. They have fancy terms for them, but they're simple ideas. Rule-based ethics. Some authoritative person or structure or whatever gives you rules of what's right and wrong. Follow the rules. That's how to be a good person. Second, pragmatic ethics. If you want to achieve certain goals, then these are the behaviors that will help you achieve your goals. And those are outcome-based ethics. And then third is this field called virtue ethics. And one of our struggles, I think, in our global civilization is that traditional religions were the experts on rule-based ethics, and they're losing all credibility. They can't follow their own rules, and their authority is looking pretty thin right now. And pragmatic ethics, we're really struggling with on many, many levels, because in many ways, capitalism has taught us our ethical system, and a very extractive kind of capitalism has taught us what our common sense about what's important. And we're ill-equipped to deal with this. And when we when we see that we're making progress, for example, in dealing with climate change, but our progress is not keeping up with our expansion of our harmful behaviors, it's easy to feel like there is no good outcome we could achieve. And I came across a quote from Vaclav Havel, who I think captured this. He said, "Hope is not the conviction that things will turn out as we wish. That's that we will get the outcomes we desire." He said, "Hope is the conviction that some things are worth doing no matter how they turn out." The irony is, when you decouple your ethics from outcomes and you say, "This is the kind of person I feel I should be, even if I fail, I would rather be loyal to this vision of what humans should be and could be, even if I fail, that's what I'm going to be." You increase the chances of things turning out the way you wish than if you give up as soon as you can't see a way through. And that's virtue ethics, where we say, "These are the virtues I really want." So I'm sorry to go on like that, but to me, I think we need something better than optimism, than swinging back and forth between optimism and pessimism. I think we have to get clear on the virtues the kinds of people we want to be. Yeah, so for what it's worth. Yeah.
Just on optimism and pessimism, people very often say to me after I've presented about donor economics, they'll say, I love your optimism. And I'm like, oh, I didn't say that. And it's made me think a lot about it. So I often say, don't be an optimist if that makes you relax.
Yes.
It's going to be okay. We've got this. There's time. We're ingenious. We'll invent our way just to relax. You know, no. Because that will not happen. But don't be a pessimist if that makes you give up. Yes. It's too late. It's too hard. We are too many. It costs too much. There's too much power loaded against it. Because if you give up, as Bram was just saying, you will help make that true. So don't be an optimist if it makes you relax. Don't be a pessimist if it makes you give up. I'd say be an activist. There's activists in the house. And there are people who don't like, I don't want to be an activist, as if being an activist means doing that. So if you don't want to be an activist, if that doesn't feel you, be in action. Be in action in your own life in the ways I was saying before, how you shop and travel and invest and divest. And we can all be in action. And for hope, I think, you know, I'm not for hope with its fingers crossed. I hope that happens. I like hope with its sleeves rolled up. I'm in it. I'm doing it. And that's exactly what you were just saying. Look, I'm acting. That's my active hope.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kate. Brilliant. And I guess people can either kind of have a question for the whole panel, or you can direct your questions at one of our merry band. Thank you. Yeah, sure. Power. Okay. Yeah, this guy with his hand up here, hopefully we'll get a mic to you, or if you're able to come to the front as well, that would be fantastic. This guy here.
Almost the opposite of what this quote, of the quote that inspired this panel, is kind of this Thatcherite idea that there is actually no alternative. So is what we're saying here that the thing that the world's looking for is something beyond a neoliberal capitalism? It's something new and different beyond that.
Kate?
Sure. Let's start with the very, very easy questions. So capitalism, I always like to unpack that word, because if I just go capitalism, I bet there's at least 100 different meanings of what we're talking about. I would hand the microphone back and say, sir, what do you mean by neoliberal capitalism? For me, capitalism means an economy that is structurally designed to generate returns to the owners of capital, who then can turn it into more capital and get more returns. And it's designed, whether we're wittingly part of it or not, its institutions are designed to generate and protect the returns to capital. I think we need a different economy. I don't see how an economy that's structured and designed to do that can simultaneously be in service to meeting the rights of all people and keeping the whole of humanity within the means of the living planet. So I see these as fundamentally misaligned designs. I would like to see an economy that's in service to life, to human life and all life, not in service to the returns to capital. Without trying to go deep, deep, deep into that, there's a wonderful book that I find really useful for unpacking this question, if anybody would like to think more about it. It's by an author called Eric Olin Wright, with a W, Wright. It's called How to Be an Anti-Capitalist in the 21st Century. Just a spoiler alert, he's a socialist and I'm not. I don't fully agree with his conclusions, but the way he sets out his argument, his ethics, his objections to capitalism, and then he says, do we want a revolution? Here's why I don't think that's going to happen. Are we going to dismantle it by the state? I don't think that's going to happen. Is it going to collapse? Just the clarity with which he does it, and it's a really short little book. So if anybody's thinking, I would actually love something that I might not necessarily agree with it, but that really helped me think clearly, I massively recommend it. Eric Olin Wright, How to Be an Anti-Capitalist, if you want, in the 21st century. But personally, I think we need an economy that would be regenerative, distributed by design, the design of companies and the design of finance would be so different that Margaret Thatcher wouldn't like it. And we wouldn't be calling it capitalism. That's my personal view. I don't think, though, we sweep this away. Because I think when you sweep things away, it is the most vulnerable who will definitely get trampled on. So I would not try to sweep it away. We're back to the dilemma that Brian was talking about at the beginning. You try to bring through the new world that's breathing. And I think Arundhati Roy's quote is still true. Another world is still possible and always was possible. And she's always breathing and she still is breathing. The question is, can she arise and really be the breath? So when will we choose to make that other economy happen? That's my thought.
Fantastic. Thank you. Another question. Oh, there are some lovely hands up at the front. Maybe. Ooh. Yep.
I'm just wondering, talked about sustainability, whether your donut economy includes the concept of the circular economy. For example, take this spray can we have just drunk, now and left a piece of metal. I think about all the energy and resource gone to make this. Now what do you do with this? Will not be reused again.
Oh, all right, that's one. Oh, well, that was a good example. First thing, circular economy. Thank you for that question. Circular economy is not just about recycling. In fact, in a really smart circular economy, recycling would be the last thing you do. The first thing you do is reuse. You'd share, like we just did with a microphone. You would refurbish, remake, repair. You could upcycle. But just to bring it to your really specific example, in Denmark, not with tin cans, but with bottles, they have one type of bottling system. They probably have, I don't know, five different kinds of bottles that drinks can be packaged in. And each company has to use those bottles. They can put their own labels on, but the bottles get returned. Customers get a 10 pence back. They go back into the system. They get washed. They get reused. They get relabeled. That is a smart reuse system. And I think we're going to go beyond the tin can and use systems that are... And by the way, the really important point there is there is a commons, right? There's a commons of bottles. So a collective sharing of bottling above individual companies. I don't think individual companies are ever going to take us to a circular economy because they're not designed to do that. We need collaboration at the industry scale. And it's not anti-competitive. Sometimes governments won't even let those companies talk to each other. Oh, you must be colluding. Actually, we're trying to work together on how we can use bottles together, how we can reuse tires in the car industry. So we need that kind of collaboration at industry scale to make reuse possible.
Thank you. Arundhati's quote, she really invokes the feminine. And I'm just wondering how important the feminine is in our reimagining and in the breathing and the type of the world that we're moving towards. So how important is the feminine?
Oh, I actually have a microphone in my lap. You know, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I mentioned earlier that I'm a single mother of three children, and I found myself kind of, you know, I think it depends on what your philosophy is on your spirituality or your sense of what feminine energy is versus masculine energy, but I find myself often having to present this more like what I consider a masculine like kind of shield with which to navigate my life, and have been thinking of really wanting to settle into my femininity in a way that is like I feel safe and protected and not like I have to be the strong person that knows what to say all the time. This is a great moment to say that out loud. But, you know, I think about that on a community level. It means like we all
have that need to feel safe and protected. And, you know, it's not about weak versus strong. It's actually like, you know, the most vulnerable people deserve protection. And I think that's as a baseline is kind of, you know, a potential like conception of dipping into an awareness of that kind of feminine side of society. I don't know if that completely answers your question, but that's my response.
Yeah, no, just one other comment maybe in relation to that. I was fascinated by the discussion around Kamala Harris's wardrobe, you know, and they were saying, oh, she's dressing herself as a commander in chief because she can't be too feminine. And, you know, I think just the patriarchy overlays absolutely everything. And I think it's great that the US may be finally about to have a female president for the first time. But it's not enough for us to just have to kind of pretend that we're men. And I hope that what Arundhati is nodding to is like this fully embodied ability to be kind of more vulnerable and more open to the possibilities of the world.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'll try and answer this as concisely as possible. We're talking about improving the world, and I suspect that a wonderful festival like Greenbelt, there's an awful lot of consensus on what that looks like. And you sort of touched on some of that, you know, social justice, climate justice, equity and stuff. But there are heaps of people, and we all know some of them, whose fundamental picture of what an improved world would look like is completely different. It's not just that they sort of disagree on how to get there. It's that the things that they believe would, you know, the goals we ought to be striving towards are so different. So my question is basically, how do we bring alongside / convince / cajole / defeat those people?
Well, I'll say something briefly about that. We just get in a fist fight and knock them down. And that, yeah. No, I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that's going to work. Listen, this is the process of social change, which involves a million different people doing a million different things in a million different places, right? It's a very chaotic and complex system of change. But if I can give everybody one simple thing to do, I'll give you a little script. Try it, experiment with it, and see if it helps. When you hear those people say something you think is really wrong, don't be quiet. Don't be silent. Don't let it go unchallenged. But I'd like to give you this script. Here it is. 5 words. Wow. I see that differently. Want to try it?
Wow. I see that differently.
One more time.
Wow. I see that differently.
Chosen carefully because first wow says there's emotion, but I don't have to yell. I, not you're an idiot, not you're wrong. That just gets into ego versus ego. I'm going to be vulnerable. And I see, I'm not claiming I'm right, you're wrong. I'm telling you how I see it. I see that differently. And almost always when you say that, then a person will say, well, what do you mean? And usually I will say to them, if there are other people around, I'll say, if you'd like to ask me about that in private, I'll be glad to discuss it with you in private. Because if other people are around, it's almost always performing for the other people rather than really communicating with you. Sometimes you take the risk and you do it. But all I'm saying is, if we could see every criticism, every ignorant statement as an opportunity to speak and clarify an alternative message, I think that would help us. And so I hope that'll be useful. Yeah.
Okay, hi. I think this question's for Layla. And it's, I believe you said that you went to New Orleans 15 years ago, which must have been just 4 years after Hurricane Katrina, which devastated the entire city. So I'm just thinking, like, sort of, wow, what kind of, wow, I see things differently. What was your inner motivation And I'm partly asking this because I think it'd be an interesting insight into the way you saw things differently, and also because I think in the years and decades to come, where quite a number of us are going to face sort of similar scenarios where there's some kind of extreme climate weather thing or some kind of like personal kind of situation, certainly, or community environment that's going to present us with similar choices and similar sort of opportunities. So I'd really like to hear what motivated you and sort of what you saw in it going to New Orleans then.
When I moved to New Orleans, it was a few years after I had graduated from college. I was bartending, teaching, playing at churches, playing on everyone that I knew's record. Like, I was very all over the place. And I really wanted to figure out for myself how to just focus on whether I should be a musician and like write music and what that could look like. And so when I moved to New Orleans, you know, it's a place that runs on its tourism. And it was a place that I could go and play my cello. I lived there. I mean, for the first year that I lived there, I was playing music in the street as my living. And it was like this way that I could just be like, I'm only going to play music. I don't have to do a million jobs. And, you know, that just reflects what it's like to be a young person, I guess, in New York City. That's where I was born. That's where I went to school. You know, university, that's where I learned a lot about how to play cello and started improvising and, you know, being a part of a kind of cultural scene of musical exploration. But New Orleans gave me this opportunity to focus. And on some level, it was an economic decision. I was just like, I don't want to pay rent in this city anymore and without an idea of what my end game is. My end game is I want to be a musician. I want to create. I didn't know what I was going to create. I didn't know, you know, what music I was like kind of calling towards me. But I think it was that openness to new people at that time as well. I mean, you know, after Katrina, the population of New Orleans dropped by like 200,000 people. So many people were displaced. And a lot of those people were Black culture bearers of the city, who still live in Houston and Chicago and Atlanta and, you know, places outside of the city. So for me, it was, you know, it was a very personal decision. It wasn't like I'm going to go to ground zero and rebuild it. It was like, no, I can be fed by what's happening culturally there. But there's still remnants of Katrina. There's still remnants of the tragedy of that. And the biggest remnant of that, I think, is our political system has not, you know, been particularly generous to its citizens. It's been Airbnb and going back to the tourism industry. It's a lot of, you know, using the local culture to attract revenue, not to promote sustainability. And so, you know, I understand that so much more now than when I first moved there. And, you know, now I've lived there 15 years, so I have a more of a feeling of like, oh, something is not right. And, you know, I think that happens all over the South and in the United States, and particularly in the South, all over the United States, all over the world in general. But, you know, our cities have become, you know, yeah, it's like, how do we, the people that are really benefiting from living in a particular place, they it's usually the people who already had enough money to be able to decide to live there. I was very renegade, like grassroots. I was just playing Bach on Royal Street in the French Quarter. So, you know, I had a very different experience, very individual kind of path, but, you know, when I see myself in the context of all that was happening and all that is continues to unfold, you know, I'm seeing like, wow, it's really hard to own anything here unless you already have a lot of money, especially as an artist, or, you know, and maybe that's maybe it's an American problem, but maybe it's also here. No, it's all over.
I feel better. yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
Thank you.
Whatever you said, it's going
to
be great.
Great. I'm afraid we have to finish there. Thank you. Can we have a round of applause for Kate, Brian, Grace, and Layla? And before you all go, can we have all have a wave to the green fairy over here, who's come to see us? If you have any suggestions about making Greenbelt greener, please go and see him on your way out. Thank you very much. Have a great evening, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.